This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The results are in. Republicans are reveling in their victories across the country last night, including here in North Carolina. State Speaker of the House Tom Tillis narrowly defeated incumbent Democratic Senator Kay Hagan. It was one of seven seats that secured a Republican majority in the U.S. Senate. We're going to take a look at the election and the rest of the results in North Carolina this hour with a panel of reporters and commentators. WNC reporter Dave DeWitt was in Charlotte last night at the headquarters of Tom Tillis. He's back with us. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Frank.
Also with us, Capitol Bureau Chief Jessica Jones in Greensboro with Kay Hagan. Hello, Jessica.
Hi, Frank.
And political junkie Ken Rudin is with us from New Hampshire. Hello, Ken.
Hi, Frank.
Dave, close race. Polls show Kay Hagan had a slight edge going into this election. How did Tom Tillis pull off the win?
Well, I think he got his people to the polls. I mean, it's that sort of midterm 6 years into a presidency rule that the opposition party is going to get their people out and there's going to be a big turnover. You know, the polls all showed that Hagan had a one-point lead, some played a three-point lead. It was all within the margin of error. And so as people came into the ballroom last night with the Tillis campaign and supporters, they were cautiously optimistic and maybe had a little more confidence outwardly. But, you know, when you get them in the corner, they'd say, oh, you know, we're going to look and be really uncomfortable for a while. And we think the early voting is going to go Hagan's way. And then the early voting came in. It wasn't huge for Hagan. And then as the outer counties and rural areas started reporting, you started to see that Tillis was doing really well there, like most people thought he would. And once he got the lead, it was pretty clear that the night was over and he was going to win. And then the mood changed dramatically in the room.
Well, Jessica, it was clear then, Dave says, in that room. What about the Hagan campaign? Again, 1 and 2 point leads by most polls. That is well within the margin of error. How confident were they going in, and did the mood change over time? Could you tell if they were expecting to win, or did they know somehow that it was going to turn out this way?
Well, Frank, I feel like my experience last night was sort of the mirror opposite of Dave's. When I went in, the people on the campaign were feeling pretty good. They knew that it was a close race, but I think people in the room thought that she was going to win, albeit by a small margin. And hour after hour, the mood in the room really changed. Toward the end, people really thinned out. I think they were heading to the VIP section, people who were working on the campaign to kind of commiserate. I saw people wiping their eyes a little bit before the announcement was ever made, about an hour before that. So the mood changed dramatically last night at Hagan headquarters.
Ken Rudin, I'll ask you kind of two questions. The first question I asked Dave DeWitt, which is how did Tillis do it? And secondly, were there indications along the way that this was going to be how it turned out? Could you tell going in?
Well, actually, this was the only Senate race in the country that surprised me. I bought the polls that had Hagan winning by a slight margin. I thought that the fact that President Obama, by making a late-minute radio ad on behalf of Hagan, was an indication that the White House could risk doing something like that because he thought she would win, and I thought she would. The fact that Tillis did win meant, you know, exactly what we heard today, that the fact that his support came home, his supporters came out, I should say, and all the talk about 7-8 percentage points for the Libertarian candidate, that didn't materialize. Libertarian only got about 3.7% of the vote. I suspect that may have been among from those people who thought that a vote for the Libertarian would help Kay Hagan, and thus they came home to the Republican.
What about turnout? We were told that going into this, that was going to be key to this race. If you took a look at early voting, which generally favors Democrats, there was an indication that voter turnout would be much higher. It was not much higher. It was only fractionally higher than it had been in the previous midterm election. What do you make of turnout in North Carolina when we knew the stakes were so high and Lord knows we knew about the race?
Well, actually, given the fact that, and by the way, I've been singing your praises all night long. Every time I've talked to a radio station, they say, oh, our state is the most negative ever. I say, oh, no. North Carolina is by far the most negative. So I thought with all that nonstop onslaught of negative ads that it would dampen turnout, that voters on both sides, certainly on the Democratic side, would be more discouraged. Yes, the numbers who showed up, the people who came out to the polls yesterday, was marginally up from 2010, the last midterm, But the point is, it was still a North Carolina record for a midterm turnout. And given all the negativity, given all the anger that was out there, I think it's just surprised me that there was a bigger turnout than we've seen in the past.
Yeah, and we should point out it was a record in total numbers. But, of course, the population of the state of North Carolina has been growing dramatically over the years. In terms of percentages, it's not a record. There have been higher turnouts over the last couple of decades. So kind of it's a wash. But your point is well taken. It wasn't suppressed. It wasn't lower than we would expect, given the fact that it was such a negative campaign, a pox on both of your houses. Dave, let's talk about what happens. The Tillis victory, of course, is something that helps the Republicans gain a majority in the United States Senate. Here in North Carolina, it means there's an open position for Speaker of the House in the North Carolina House of Representatives. What does that race look like?
Well, I think everybody believes it's going to be Paul Stamm. It's probably going to be the next one up that's going to be in the North Carolina House. So I think that's there certainly could be an outside person. You know, that Tom Tillis was that guy. You know, 12 years ago, Tom Tillis was just a guy who wanted a bike trail near his house in Cornelius. You know, he was a guy who went to the local board, parks board, and got on that board because nobody else wanted the job. And then he came up through the town council and spent 6 years in the House. So it was a meteoric rise for him, and there's nothing to say that can't happen in a legislature, you know, the state legislature that has really been turned upside down in the last few years. So there's a lot of different people who can come from different places. We didn't see a lot of turnover in this last election, so there will be some more people returning. There'll be a little more institutional knowledge. It'll be interesting to see how they run with this, what they say is a referendum, and how they feel like they can take what the voters have told them, that the state is going in the right direction, and how they try to press in different areas.
Jessica, how will this be read? I mean, we know that the Senate has been, at least in this last session, more conservative than the House. The House has been running a little bit to the left of the Senate, which is to say still on the right, the governor as well. Does this race become a referendum? What about the leadership of the House, and what can we expect to see in terms of kind of the ideology of the House going forward with new leadership?
Well, I think it all depends on who the new leaders are in the House. But in reference to your remarks about the Senate, Senate President Phil Berger has been talked about as some people will say, well, he's politically the most powerful person in the state. And I think that this solidifies his position in the state, because now that Tom Tillis is going to be gone, he is still there holding forth. And I think we're going to see I think it's going to be really interesting to see the legislation that comes out of the Senate this time around.
And the Senate certainly has pulled dramatically, extremely to the right. So we'll see what happens going forward. Ken, let's take a quick look at the other races for the U.S. House in North Carolina. Can you run through those for us?
Well, basically, there were not much that we were looking at. There was nobody expected big turnout, big changes, big turnover in the legislature. I mean, of course, there was a lot of attention on the second district with Renee Elmers and Clay Aiken, and of course, you know, I guess. And when we do TV shows, I think that wasn't the American Idol. One of the you pick your worst loser, your favorite loser.
Well, yeah, he's a runner up again. Second
right,
again,
well,
Clay Aiken.
Exactly. Well, exactly. Given all the attention that he got, that the race was not that really close. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in the 6th District, where Howard Coble gave up, there was a lot of talk about maybe the Republican candidate was too conservative. The fact that Phil Berger Jr. lost the primary and the right wing had taken over the Republican Party, that wasn't close either. And as expected, in the 7th District, where Mike McIntyre was retiring, the Republican David Rausser picked up that seat. So, for the most part, North Carolina seemed to be emblematic of what was going on around the country. A solid Republican, and you know, either it's anti-Obama. It's hard to make the case that everything was simply anti-Obama, because I think Kay Hagan certainly tried to make the Senate race a referendum on what the state legislature was doing regarding women's rights and voter ID and reproductive choice and things like that. And the fact that that failed, it just seemed like that it was more of an ideological tide, if nothing else, than an anti-Obama tide.
What do you make of Sean Haugh's candidacy here? He got about almost 4% of the vote. A lot of money was spent, again, $500,000 from outside groups on Sean Haugh, from groups that would apparently favor Tillis. So there's some sense somehow that he would help the Tillis campaign. But exit polls show that 5% of the white vote which was primarily the Tom Tillis vote, that comes to 107,000 votes. Most of the people who voted for Sean Haugh, it can be argued, were Tillis voters. Can we say that he had an impact on the race at all?
Oh, I think so. I think from the beginning, the Republicans were very fearful that Haugh would be the Republicans' Ralph Nader, that Kay Hagan could win by siphoning off votes for conservatives or libertarians, to siphon off votes away from Tillis and towards Haugh, the libertarian candidate. Plus the fact that not every Tea Party Republican in the state was madly in love with Tom Tillis from the beginning. We saw a very contentious May primary where the Republican conservatives basically tried to make the argument that Tillis was not sufficiently conservative. But again, I think there was a feeling at the end that if they really do have a chance of winning this seat, if they really have a chance of defeating Kay Hagan, a lot of these Republicans who were winking at or eyeing at or just being cozying up to the Libertarian candidate came back to the Tillis campaign. I know I saw a lot of reports that it's unclear where the Libertarian gets his votes from, where he takes it away from. I really thought that from the beginning he had the opportunity to give Hagan a second term, and as it turned out, he did not.
All right. It's the morning after. We're talking about yesterday's election results. Political junkie Ken Rudin stays with us as we look at the impact of money and the ground game as our conversation continues. And we thank WNC reporters Dave DeWitt and Jessica Jones, who covered the U.S. Senate race. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thanks, Frank.
Thanks.
Coming up, there's more ahead on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Yesterday marked the first general election since the North Carolina legislature enacted new voting laws. The NAACP has been one of the driving forces critical of those new measures and other actions by the General Assembly. Those have been expressed through the Moral Monday protests. They claim the new laws suppress minority voting. Turnout for this year's election narrowly surpassed the 2010 midterm numbers. President pro tem Phil Berger yesterday said the results show the state's people in the state are very happy with the Republican-led General Assembly.
I would say that that's a validation of the change in direction that we've led North Carolina in, an indication that the people want us to continue in that direction.
And that's Phil Berger. We invited him to be on this program to tell us more. He declined. Joining me now is the Reverend William Barber, of the president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Glad to be here, Frank.
So what we're what Phil Berger says, we're going to check out that mic and make sure that that's actually working. But let me ask the question anyway. Phil Berger says, this is it, validation of everything that you have protested against. You've led protested against the General Assembly. He says, look at these results. Everybody's for us.
Well, actually, I would have declined, too, if that was my comment. The fact is, this is a big moral and political victory. Despite voter suppression, despite the money, despite every tactic to suppress the vote, people turned out in a way they did not turn out in 2010. And it was a very diverse electorate. The fact of the matter is, if you have all of this money, you have control of state government, you have all these tools of voter expression and you voter suppression, and you can only eke out a small, minute victory in a statewide race. That is not a compliment to you. That is actually a repudiation. It shows that the real fight is going to be 2 years from now in 2016.
All right, let me put it another way. Kay Hagan spent 30% more overall. Mm-hmm. She's the incumbent. She has a huge advantage as incumbent. She mm-hmm. spent more money than Tom Tillis. Mm-hmm. And the voter turnout was about a percentage higher than it was in 2010. Black vote, 20% in 20% of the black registered voters turned out in 2010, 21% turnout in 2014. But voter turnout wasn't that great, and Democrats spent more than Republicans.
Well, certainly, you know, this is a mid-year election. It's been since 1968 before Democrats have been able to even win in an off-year election. But I think we got a number of things. We got all the negativity. We have all the voter suppression. We saw people in lines. We saw people leaving. We're analyzing all that. We saw people get tickets yesterday for having to park too long in Durham, 2.5 hours over one precinct. People were turned to race, sent to the wrong precinct. I had to go to three different precincts myself to find mine. But the other side of that, Frank, is Democrats have got to stop running scared and run for something. And not about then stop saying what's liberal. Let's talk about what's for life. You run and make, say, Tillis own his extremist platform. Don't get away with just saying I'm running against President Obama. explain to the people why you cut Medicaid and have a press conference, Democrats, with veterans that are not getting Medicaid expansion and people who have had family members to die, and make them have to explain, why are you hurting the sick? Why are you hurting public education? Why are you hurting those working people who lost their jobs and no fault of their own, and cutting earned income tax? Democrats have got to learn to run on a deeply moral, deeply constitutional people's agenda that is not about running from what you believe, but running to it, not running scared, but running strong.
Maybe that's the answer to this question, but I want to put it another way. Since the legislature did cut $365 million from education, since they cut taxes rather than restore spending to education to bring it back to 2008 levels, since they left 500,000 people without medical coverage, since they turned away hundreds of millions of dollars in federal dollars, which show up in the polls as dissatisfaction with the General Assembly, why did Tom Tillis win?
Well, I think, again, when you talk about the voter suppression, that we don't know how many people were kept because they were denied early voting and same-day registration. The out-of-precinct voting, we don't have those numbers yet. The mess-up that we saw in the precincts, the long lines that were ridiculous, plus this constant flood of money, $100 million, and this negativity. But also, what we've seen is just in the House, the General Assembly, we always knew it would be hard. It was a long shot. If you flip it over, it should have never been this close. That's the place we're saying, from if we can get this close with all of these things against us, when we win in court next year and when we gear up for 2016, it's going to be a different thing. Look at what happened in Asheville, how several state legislators were taken out. That was partially because of our movement. Now, the last thing I'd say, Frank, on that particular point, is that we also knew, as far as the General Assembly is concerned, we have the battle of redistricting. So the game has been rigged, if you will. The Supreme Court has refused to really deal with our case because we think in the federal courts they'll lose. And so we knew all along that our movement was not based on one election or one party, that regardless of how this Senate race came out, Governor McCrory was still governor, the legislature would probably not turn, and we were going to have to continue to fight and continue to challenge this legislature, not based on liberal versus conservative, but based on our constitutional values, our moral values, and how it impacts people's lives.
Your reference to Asheville, Buncombe County Republicans, incumbents Tim Moffitt in the State House, Nathan Ramsey, both Republicans in the State House, lost to their Democratic challengers, Brian Turner and John Ager, and we're going to talk more about that later. Going forward, what's the strategy?
The strategy is, I've got message after message after message. Reverend Barber, let's gear up and fight. Let's take a day and rest. Let's get back in it. Let's keep building this fusion movement of blacks and whites and Latinos and gay and straight and people of all different races, creeds, sexuality. Look at these numbers as a sign of what's to come. This is not an end. It's a beginning. In fact, it's a repudiation of the direction we're headed in, because if you have all of those advantages and then on top of that you have voter suppression, you should have had a much bigger margin than you had last night.
Reverend William Barber, the president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, is always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend.
Well, let's take a closer look at some of the races around the state and in the state legislature. Political junkie Ken Rudin still with me. Michael Bitzer joins me now. He's a political science professor at Catawba College. Welcome back, Michael.
Good to be with you.
Also with us, Susan Roberts, a political science professor at Davidson University. Hello, Susan. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Michael, where did you see what surprised you about yesterday, if anything?
Well, we knew the U.S. Senate race was going to be basically a coin toss. Most of the political analysts who did the modeling thought that Kay Hagan would be able to pull it out. We knew it was going to be close. But in looking at midterm elections here in North Carolina, you have to understand the fundamentals. And the fundamentals were very much a lean Republican orientation in midterm elections, unlike in presidential years. Generally, 31% of all the registered voters are registered Republicans, but in a midterm, traditionally, we see about 37% of the electorate be registered Republicans. So I was always thinking it was going to be close, but my sense of the fundamentals were that indeed it was going to be a very tight election for Speaker Tillis, now Senator-elect Tillis.
Susan Roberts, what do you make of the conversation I just had with Reverend Barbara, which is to say that turnout is always important in a midterm election. It's generally always below 50%. So, a slight percentage increase on your side could turn an election. Lots to be angry about if you're on the Democratic side. New voter laws, turning away Medicaid's expansion, cuts to education spending, lots to mobilize around. And yet, really, the voter turnout was marginally higher. How do you account for that?
Well, I think you look at, I don't know exactly how some of the voting laws had an impact. A lot of people around Charlotte are saying, gee, we need more restrictive voting access to the ballot because of what happened with Patrick Cannon and voting here in Charlotte. I think that if you look at the depressed turnout, it may not be that fewer people cared about it. It just may be we couldn't estimate the ground game. I had some students that were telling me some groups from Atlanta and South Carolina came in to canvass and work for Tom Tillis. That's always the consideration. And one thing that I think you look at what happened, and in terms of, as Reverend Barber says, about access to abortion, reproductive rights, the Moral Monday protest, and also if you look at some of the questions about North Carolina had the most restrictive at the time laws about access to the abortion and the ballot. What signal does that send to the Republicans, both nationally and in the state, about, I don't want to use the term, what they can get away with, but how far they can push to the right?
How about that, Michael, in terms of turnout? Do you think the turnout should have been larger? Again, you can look at this two ways, that what the left would call voter suppression worked. On the other hand, that should mobilize voters from the left, so we should see more of them. We didn't. What do you make of turnout?
Well, certainly it matched what we saw percentage-wise in 2010, 44-45% turnout. We did see increased numbers in terms of the raw numbers, but I have to think that, $100 million spent particularly on the air campaign, all the negative ads, take 20 to 30% of it and invest it in the ground game, as Susan said. That's where the real operation of modern-day campaigning is. If you can turn out even slight numbers, 1, 2, maybe 3%, of your own registered voters, for example, among registered Democrats, if those numbers could turn out, and the early numbers seem to be in the suburbs, that's where Tillis seemed to was able to beat Senator Hagan, according to my numbers so far. If you could turn those numbers out just minuscule, that could potentially flip the election. And remember, we're only talking about less than 50,000 votes that separated Tillis from Hagan. So, again, it is all about who is on the ground and who is doing that mobilization. Democrats had the anger. That is definitely was on their side. They just weren't able to get those folks to show up to vote, in my opinion.
Susan, and you made the point first about the sort of getting that mobilization going. Is there evidence of that working? I mean, it sounds theoretically, when you look at the money spent on the air war, and then you say, we should have put more people on the ground. Is there evidence of sort of campaigns making that calculation and it paying off?
Well, I think if we look back at Obama's campaigns and the way he really perfected the art of micro-targeting, that works both in the air game and the ground game. And I think when we look at what the Democrats tried to do in this election, I think for some reason we thought that Kay Hagan had a superior ground game. I want to also mention that, there's some things we just don't know how to factor in. I was one of the very few people that perhaps watched the non-debate, and I don't know if that would have an impact on the election or not, because if you looked at it, Tom Tillis had the opportunity to go way beyond the sound bites and to portray himself as he may well be, but to get to the voters. I'm not that person you see in those ads, as he had in one ad, but it was a very reasonable kind of assessment to say, gee, maybe they're pushing too hard with the negative ads. One thing about turnout I meant to mention is that people think that negative ads tend to suppress turnout, and actually the political science literature is pretty divided on this. It does not necessarily depress turnout. Most people would say that we sure had the negative ads. We did have a slightly higher turnout, but I think that we need to look at that in consideration of some of the money spent. This race, you know, this is the state of things. North Carolina was a lot like the nation. If you look at money spent, if you look at job approval, if you look at negativity, that's what I've been thinking about in terms of why we need to look at this battleground state. And I don't like to call it a swing state, but a battleground state.
Well, Ken, what about that? I mean, if we take a look at the money, take one step back. Number one, it may be a myth that negative campaigns suppress voting. The other myth is that money can buy a campaign. Kay Hagan outspent Tom Tillis, even though he had more outside money. The fact is, Kay Hagan spent about 30% more than Tillis overall and lost. What part did money play?
Well, there's so much been said in the last 10, 15 minutes that I'd love to comment on, everything from Reverend Barber to the conversation we're having now. The conversation may not have to be, why did Kay Hagan lose and what's wrong with the Democratic turnout? Maybe the Republicans actually learned something from the great vaunted Obama ground game of 2012. Maybe their anger with President Obama, maybe the Democrats disenchantment with the Obama agenda, either from the left or from whatever, kept many Democrats at home. What I'm saying is that instead of talking about why Kay Hagan lost and what happened to, and we're talking about voter suppression and the repudiation of the Tillis legislative record, why is this not a victory for the state legislature? Frank, as you asked Reverend Barber, why isn't this basically an acceptance of the fact that the Republicans learned from their failures of the past, that they got a ground game when they needed it the most, and the Democrats just didn't have that enthusiasm?
Did we do we have any indication that it was a better ground game? And that Michael Bitzer, let me ask you, if perhaps the Tillis campaign and Republicans in general turned out a larger percentage of their voters than they did in, say, 2010?
Well, we're still trying to figure out, and the data is not yet from the State Board of Elections, but we do know that 38% of this year's ballots came in early voting, and Kay Hagan won in the early votes in person 52-44. But when you have 60% of the ballots coming on election day, and Tom Tillis is able to take that particular balloting method 51-44, I think, again, we're seeing the traditional approach in North Carolina, particularly since 2008, as Susan mentioned, of Democrats trying to bank early votes, but Republicans usually winning on election day. This is a pattern that we tended to see. What I would argue is that North Carolina has become, like the nation, a pretty much polarized state, that there are very few undecided, persuadable voters. I look at the electorate as pretty much a 45-45 split for both sides. You're not going to persuade a potential North Carolina Democrat to vote Republican, even though there are these old-time conservative Democrats still around. Republicans are not going to vote for Democrats. And even though we've got the rise of the unaffiliated, they may be already partisan in their leanings. So I think North Carolina, again, is kind of this classic mirror of the country, and that we're seeing this polarization play out now in midterms as well as presidential years.
Well, Ken Rudin, then that's kind of leads to the question, what does this mean nationally? Certainly Republicans can make the same argument at the national level that this is a validation of Republican policies and a clear mandate to somehow to replace the policies or to counter and push back against Barack Obama. Do they make that claim, and are they successful?
Well, they're certainly making the claim, obviously, when you have big, huge victories for the Senate, and not only in the Senate, in the gubernatorial races. How do the Republicans win in Maryland? How do they win in Maine? I mean, there are a lot of states that were very friendly to President Obama that the Republicans did well. So obviously, they're trying to portray this as a repudiation of President Obama, repudiation of the Democrats, and an affirmation that what the Republicans stand for. The question is whether they want to show the country in the next 2 years how they intend to govern, what their agenda is, because it's much easier to be in the minority and just carp from the outside and say, well, vote, let's vote no, let's vote no, let's vote no. But as Mitch McConnell is now the majority leader, along with the Republican Speaker of the House, they're going to have to put something to the voters. And then when all is said and done in 2016, they can go to the voters and say, here's what we've done with Republican control. Let's extend it to the White House.
I wonder what that means. At the national level, there's a Democratic chief executive, not so here in North Carolina. And Susan Roberts, still the North Carolina legislature now is we have a veto-proof majority in both the House and the Senate, and the governor's a Republican. So how do you see the direction moving forward for the state of North Carolina in terms of policies?
Well, I think the policies may continue much as they have, and so much now is up to the states. Even if little things like marijuana reform, issues such as cloning, some of these things are still in the legislature. And I think that for the states, I think it's important to look and see where the direction is now that you have really solid support. It looks a lot better for Richard Burr than it would if Kay Hagan had won. The other thing in North Carolina, we touted, that you look at the job approval rating. It's low in North Carolina. We also have to unpack, I think, the agenda. What is just the job approval rating? I think that for Obama, it was also the way he operates and to what people perceive as the use of executive privilege to overstep his bounds. I think North Carolina represents a lot of leeway for Republicans, both in the state house and nationally. I'm not sure that there's going to be much compromise. There may be some cooperation, but not much compromise.
All right. We will continue our conversation about the North Carolina elections and national elections as our conversation on the state of things continues. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today about the results of midterm elections, what they mean for North Carolina. We'll look down the ballot now to some other races. Democrats picked up 3 seats in the state house. 2 of them were in western North Carolina, where incumbent Republicans Tim Moffitt and Nathan Ramsey were defeated. And here to talk about those races is Kirk Ross. He's Capital Bureau Chief for Carolina Public Press in Asheville. Welcome back, Kirk.
How you doing?
Doing well. Tell us about those 2 seats. 2 Republican incumbents, both in Buncombe County, were sent packing. Tell us about that race, those races.
Well, couple of interesting races. You had we'll take the Moffitt race first because it's a little bit more interesting. Tim Moffitt was a rising star in the legislature. He had a couple of committee posts. He's a young, fairly hip dude, and was moving his way up. He even had talked about running for speaker, and he was fairly soundly rejected. A couple of points, almost 3 points last night. Moffitt got into a lot of trouble with his constituents over fights with the city of Asheville. And in a way, Ramsey sort of signed on to this agenda, and that's one of the reasons that he went down as well. There was a real backlash to the legislature stepping in and basically taking away the city's authority over the city of Asheville water system, which had spread out to a lot of Buncombe and part of Henderson County. And so that big fight went to court. Moffitt ran a bill that was obviously a very local bill, but it was officially a statewide bill. He was kind of coy about that, and the courts really shot it down, said it was unconstitutional, that it was a taking of the water system. This is a 100-year-old battle out in Buncombe County. And it goes back a long way, and there's a lot of intensity around it. But you had a real city-county fight going on there, and you saw this in a few places around the state in the last legislative session where you had these scores being settled with the change in the legislature.
What about Nathan Ramsey?
Nathan Ramsey, farmer running against his next-door neighbor farmer. Very, very local race. And here again, I think because Ramsey had signed on to this, he was a Buncombe County Board of Commissioners chair for a couple of terms, and he had his own fights with Asheville. And I think he, probably more than Moffitt, was the victim of a perception about mainly environmental issues and the legislative leadership. Fracking actually became a big issue out west because they had talked about doing some testing and exploration out there. And people got really upset over it. And even though Ramsey said he was opposed to the testing offered to introduce a bill against it, there's a lot of signs out there that say no fracking, and I think it really tied into him being a part of the Republican Party. It helped bring him down.
Right.
In both cases, you had very well-funded opponents. They were able to raise good money. Usually, in the Moffitt Turner race, this is going to be over a $1 million race.
We're talking about a state house seat. We're talking about
Yeah. I don't think it pays less than $30,000 a year.
Michael Bitzer, let me ask you a question now. There were a number of these battles, these kind of local control battles, when the Republicans took the legislature here in Durham. Questions about Jordan Lake, Charlotte as well had these questions, and also in Wake County, moving control of the buildings and the school buildings from the Democratic-controlled school board to the county commission, which had been a Republican-controlled. That has changed. We'll talk about that in a minute. It seems to me that those fights, while it seemed to be trouble for two lawmakers in Buncombe County, otherwise, given how well Tillis did elsewhere and the fact that he lost those urban areas, does it matter to the legislature to pick those fights? It seems like they are held harmless, even if they sort of have those local control battles. Is that true?
I think certainly Republicans will look at it in kind of isolation. The two races up west in the state, along with Tom Murray's district there in Wake County. Charlotte certainly had a lot of blowback regarding the airport, and the issue is still held up in the courts. But I think this is kind of moving towards the classic division that North Carolina politics is now being focused on, and that is the urban suburban-rural divide. Particularly urban areas have become much more Democratic, and what we're seeing is the battle in kind of suburban North Carolina. Republicans truly control the rural areas. So when a legislature that is primarily rural-dominated but with suburban Republicans comes into contact with local officials, particularly urban Democratic controlled areas, you're going to have this natural tension. And, you know, Republicans argued that the best power is kept closest to the people until they got into power in the state and then found out, oh, we can use our state power to tell local governments, particularly Democratic ruled cities, what they can and can't do. So I think this tension is going to be played out even further going into the new General Assembly session.
Susan Roberts, do you think that the Republican-dominated legislature has to pay attention to the loss of those three seats?
Well, I think that they do, but I think that I'm curious about, and you talked about, I couldn't agree more than I do with Michael about the urban-rural divide. If you took a map about Amendment 1, would it look exactly the same as the map county by county for Tom Tillis? And I think that it would. I think a lot of people are looking at North Carolina as a state in which you can push the boundaries, as I said, and I think Reverend Barber said as well, there may need to be pushback on a progressive agenda, but I think one or two seats won't change the momentum or the enthusiasm gap that was national and is felt in North Carolina, even though we can't measure it.
Well, let's take a look down the ballot now. Joining us now are WUNC reporters Jorge Valencia and Rima Crace. They were following state and local elections last night. Jorge, Rima, welcome to the show.
Hey, Frank.
Hi, Frank.
Rima, you were watching races for county commission seats in Wake County. Where do things stand on the board right now?
Well, as you mentioned, all four Democrats won seats on the Wake County Board of Commissioners. And so since 2010, the Republicans have held the majority on the board. But the four were the Republicans. And as I said, all four Democrats won. They beat out Joe Bryan, Paul Coble, Rich Gianni, Phil Matthews, and the new folks are John Burns, Matt Calabria, Jessica Holmes, and Sig Hutchinson. And they led by at least 9 percentages, at least 9 percentage points.
Interestingly enough, they more or less ran as a block, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. I mean, they ran together even yesterday at the Wake County Democratic Party. They were standing side by side, thanking voters and their supporters. But, you know, it's some of them are saying that it's surprising, but it also makes some sense because, you know, Wake County is divided into 7 districts with one member of the Board of Commissioners serving from each district. But all voters get to vote on all for all board candidates. So it makes sense since to some degree that we saw the sweep. I think we could have seen it in the other direction. But also we've seen just lots of outside spending. Legislative candidates and their supporters have poured a lot of money into campaigns and have really honed it into Wake County districts. So with this intense injection of outside money that very much supported Democrats, I think it made sense that it permeated to the down ballot races.
Jorge, there were also seats up for grabs on the state Supreme Court and Court of Appeals. Where do things stand in those races?
Yeah, all this work that we've been talking about, of laws that are coming from the General Assembly, a lot of it, the controversial laws, wind up in the court system. So the key here to remember is that the two highest courts in the state are held by majority conservative members. So right now, what happened yesterday in the state Supreme Court is that we have at least 5 of the 7 members are justices who were endorsed by the Republican Party. Just as a reminder, it's actually a nonpartisan race, but these are people who are endorsed by the Republican Party. Interestingly, there's one seat that is in contest right now still. And this is between Justice Sherry Beasley, she's an incumbent, and Winston-Salem attorney Mike Robinson. And this was, to some, this was a surprise. This race is so close that he is within a tenth of a percentage point. He's close enough to ask for a recount. I talked to him this morning. He said that he is going to file for that recount. He got Justice Beasley got 1.23 million votes, and he got 1.22 million votes. So that's a really close one right now.
And that forces it. And Susan Roberts, these races matter because, as you pointed out earlier, if you take a look at the Amendment 1 vote and then overlay that to the Senate vote, there's a pretty good correspondence. That vote was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, the Amendment 1 turned over by the U.S. Supreme Court. State courts have played a role as well. Some of the voting legislation has been overturned by the courts. So where progressives have seen any victories at all, it's not in that map that you just described, but in the courts. These court races really matter, don't they, Susan?
They really do. And I was curious about, and I haven't seen the figures about the drop-off when you came, going down ballot, even on some of the ones that aren't judicial races, because no straight ticket voting, even though these are not partisan races. I'm just curious to figure out how that played into some of the interest going down ballot. I think also we have to look at the courts. They're, what goes around comes around. I think we looked at some of these. Tom Tillis and Phil Berger were working very, diligently to try to change the same-sex marriage with money that I think, and I may be wrong, that was not coming out of, the pocket. They were the state bureau, state pocket, but their own pocket. And that just shows you, I think, that these things can turn on a dime.
Michael, what about that? And also the amount of spending now down the ballot. I mean, it is interesting, the drop-off, the number of ballots that are not cast by people who go and just vote for the top, maybe the Senate campaign. And yet there's more and more money going into these local races. What impact do you think that's having?
I think it certainly is having the impact. You know, when you get down the ballot, as Susan has mentioned before, the information that voters have regarding state Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, even down to the district and superior local courts is so low that, you know, candidates are seeking any way that they can get information out. In the Charlotte area, we actually had superior court judges running television ads in order to try and break through all of the noise coming from the U.S. Senate race. And I think what we're seeing is this trickle-down effect. You know, we talked about the impact of money in presidential campaigns and now in Senate campaigns and congressional campaigns. I think this is actually flowing down into state legislative and state judicial races, and we're only going to see it increase along with third parties, kind of political action committees, getting engaged and getting involved in this as well. So it is really diffusing within the electorate in all races.
Well, let me stay with you, Michael, but I'll put the question to Susan as well. Maybe that's good news. Maybe it will generate more interest in those races that traditionally have not drawn votes. Could I look at it that way?
You certainly could. I think, you know, the natural reaction for most voters is to default to kind of the partisan labels. And if candidates for judicial races kind of, you know, they're running as nonpartisans, but if they let it be known that, yes, indeed, I'm more of a Democrat or I'm more of a Republican, that would at least send a cue to the voters as to how they could potentially be voting. The big question in terms of the theoretical aspect is, do you want judges to be partisan elected officials just as legislators and executive officers are?
What do you think about that, Susan? Would more money in these races draw interest? And to answer Michael's question, do we want partisan battles? Do we want how they feel to be out in the open and part of the debate?
Well, I think we look at the Supreme Court and we can see, you know, it's just a sleight of hand to say this is not political, even though they're appointed by the president, and that's usually by party. If we look down the ballot, there is more money, but there's more money to be spent. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. And I think money is there, whether it's outside money, whether it's something you're going to get wealthier candidates. People are going to have to put themselves up for election for some of these higher offices. And then what happens down the ballot again? You can give cues. You know, you can show where you have their ad. You could see some along with the Tillis ads. And you say conservative, you say moderate, you say activism, you say restraint. And people can take that cue as that's a Republican, that's a Democrat.
All right. Well, I want to point out one more issue that was on the ballot last night. Voters approved an amendment to the Constitution that would give criminal defendants the option to waive the right to a jury trial. About 53% of the voters said yes to that. I've got about a minute left, and you can split it, Susan and Michael. Michael, your question really is, how do you see the General Assembly, things playing out in the General Assembly next year, in the next 2 years?
I think in the next 2 years, certainly the Republicans are going to look at their numbers and say, we've got supermajority. We're going to focus on our agenda. This may be to the detriment, actually, of the governor who has to run for reelection in 2 years statewide. The legislators are insulated within their districts. Governor McCrory is not.
Susan, what's the Democratic strategy going forward?
Well, I think the Democratic strategy in terms of the state legislature has to be one of where can, you know, pick your battles. I think with the gerrymandering both at the national level and the state level, there just aren't a lot of opportunities. If you looked at how few races we talked about, Pittenger race was one of those that there wasn't even an opponent. I think we have to look at the fact that there's not going to be very much movement. So maybe, as Michael said, we need to look at the agenda, but the players are going to stay the same.
All right. I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Susan Roberts, political science professor at Davidson College. Michael Bitzer, a professor of politics and history and provost at Catawba College. Thank you. Jorge Valencia, Capital reporter at WUNC.
Thanks.
And was at the GOP campaign headquarters in Raleigh. WUNC reporter Rima Crace at the Democratic headquarters in Raleigh. Thank both of you for being on the program as well.
Thanks, Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find us at on the web at stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.